Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Liberty Talk Radio, the voice of liberation, broadcasting from our studio in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to around the world. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano, and this is your antidote to popular talk radio. This broadcast is being brought to you live on Wednesday evening, May 16, 2012. It is now 7:01 p.m. Central Daylight Time in the good old USA. Folks, it's time for us to take back control of our government now before this bureaucratic, oversized, and self-serving federal government starves us of our property, our freedom, our rights, and our liberty. To do this, we must shed conventional thinking regarding our political structure. We need to be revolutionaries in thought, dissidents in action. Only after we recognize what our government is doing to our freedom and our Constitution will we start taking it back. And this program is just about that. Good evening, everyone. During our live broadcast, we invite you to call 888-773-4496. That's 888-773-4496. Your email is always welcome to comments at libertytalkradio.com. This evening, we have as our guest, a returning guest, Andy Sutton, economist and chief investment strategist with Sutton Associates, Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, to talk to us about growth, inflation, and unemployment. Folks, I thought I knew at least what was going on. Not an astute investor, but at least an informed investor. I'm confused. I hope I learned something this evening. Let's get Andy on the line. Good evening, Andy. Is that you?
Joe, good to talk to you again.
Same here, Andy. Thank you very much for being a guest on Liberty Talk Radio. I welcome you all day. I'm anticipating. At one time, I considered myself at least an informed investor, not a savvy one, but informed. I generally knew what was going on and where I was going, sort of. Let me be honest with you. I am now confused. Can you help me out?
Sure. I guess we probably should start with a continuation of what we talked about briefly here this past Sunday on your AM radio show. And we were talking about growth, inflation, and unemployment. And those are three terms that are near and dear to my heart. And I think there's a good deal of misinformation that goes on, a lot of misunderstanding. So we figured between the two of us, you and I today earlier, that it probably wouldn't be a bad idea to cover this again in a little bit more detail and give people something they can chew on the next time they hear one of these words used on the financial networks.
Right.
So where do you want to start?
Well, I want to start by just plugging my program on KFAQ, which I forgot to do, and I always forget to do it. My agent gets all sorts of conniptions. Folks, you can also listen to Liberty Talk Radio, excuse me, Andy, if I can just take a second, on 1170 KFAQ Radio, live 6 to 7 a.m. on Sunday and 7 to 8 p.m. on Saturday. Listen in and call in and all that other good stuff, just like we're doing now. I apologize, Andy. I should have mentioned that because you mentioned it, so I wanted to bring it up. Let's start off with unemployment.
All right. Well, there's basically when you hear the numbers every month, the jobs report generally comes out the first Friday of the month for the prior month. So it's reported in arrears, as it should be. And there's a couple of other surveys that are released that are non-governmental. There's the Monster Jobs Index, and there's the ADP Unemployment Report, their forecast. I'm sure you've probably seen those reports. But the big figure is the one that's released the first Friday of the month, and that's the government's numbers, Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Right.
And generally, what you hear on the news is the headline number, and that's the bottom line kind of thing. Or so you would think, and they'll say, well, it's 9.5%, or recently it was 8.1%. But they never bother to really tell you how they get that number. What do they do? And I understand that they have 30 seconds or a minute or whatever it might be to report that information and then move on to something else. But without knowing how that number is derived, there's really not much point of knowing what the headline number is. If it's going down, people say, hey, this is great, the economy is getting better. If it's going up, they say, well, things are rotten, things are lousy, whatever. Now, here's some factors. And this is one of these factors. The first one I'm going to mention is something that has actually finally, after myself and probably dozens of other analysts have been hammering on this for years now, they're finally starting to talk about this, and it's the size of the workforce. And that's one of the things that's used to figure out the unemployment number. And the size of our workforce here in America is going down. It's not going up. I mean, our population is increasing slowly, but the population is increasing gradually. But the workforce, the number of people that BLS actually considers as either actively employed or seeking a job, those people, that number is going down. So what's happening here is you have people that are becoming frustrated. Now, this also includes retirees as well, to be fair. But what you have here is a situation where there's a lot of more people that are becoming frustrated and are basically giving up. So when BLS does their survey, if you haven't looked for a job in the last 12 months, you don't count anymore. You can be as unemployed as the guy who just lost his job yesterday, but you no longer count.
I see.
So this is something, obviously, that we should know when we hear that number. All right, well, it's going down, but the reason it's going down is because the workforce is getting smaller. It's not because the economy is creating all these jobs. You know, so when you hear the politicians or policymakers or academicians or whatever get up there and talk about unemployment and say, hey, you know, the government's policies, the Fed's policies are working because the headline number is going down, well, that's just not true. You know, it is going down, but, and then, you know, the real answer always comes after the word but, there's good reasons why it's coming down, and right now it's because the labor force, the workforce, is actually shrinking. That's not a good thing.
Right.
You know, our population is going up, the workforce is going down. You know, those two demographic factors are diverging, and that's not a good thing. And that's just one of the factors. Another one is those people who BLS considers to be, and this is their term, marginally attached to the workforce, and that's people who basically are sort of looking for jobs, or maybe they're skipping around to different part-time jobs. They start here, they quit there. You know, they're kind of employed, but they're kind of not. They're generally not accounted for very well.
Right.
And another group that really is a big chunk, it's pretty much the same size as the quote-unquote headline percentage, is those people that are forced to work part-time for economic reasons. In other words, full-time work is not available for whatever reason to them. They're working part-time here or there or whatever, but it's not because they are choosing to work part-time. It's because they have to. So, you know, you take a guy who was making $70,000 or $80,000 a year, maybe was a middle manager, whatever the case may be, he gets laid off, and now he's working part-time at Lowe's.
Right.
All right? So he's considered to be employed.
Even Stephen, right there, right? Even Stephen, everything's the same, right?
Yeah, exactly. Everything's the same. What we haven't accounted for is the fact that he's now working part-time, not because he wants to, but because he has to. There's nothing else that's available for him. And the second thing, and this is really hard for the government to quantify, and I'm sympathetic towards this, so I'm not going to bash him on this, but his drop in salary from $70,000 or $80,000 to $10,000 or $12,000, there's no accounting for that in the statistics either. So the purchasing power of his salary has gone down dramatically, several fold, and there's no accounting for that in the statistics. And I give him this, it would be very hard in the aggregate to really do that. Now, if they survey their 5,000 households like they do every month, and that's how they extrapolate their data, you know, they could certainly ask people those questions and come up with some kind of an index, if you will, for doing that. They haven't done that.
Right.
Now, it's probably because they want to save the taxpayers money. You know, it's probably the same reason why M3 is no longer reported.
Right, right.
Being sarcastic.
Those are two big things
that go into this headline number that they very rarely talk about. Now, in the past year or so, the U6, which is the people that are working part-time for economic reasons, they're starting to talk about that, as well as the workforce. So it is getting better, and it's because of, you know, shows like this and people who write and people who, you know, get on and talk and the alternative media and all that kind of thing. You're kind of holding the media's feet to the fire, the mainstream, and saying, hey, you guys are doing a bad job. You're misrepresenting these facts, whether it's fraudulent or not. It doesn't matter. You're misrepresenting this information, and we're gonna you know, hold your feet to the fire over this and make you do a good job.
Right.
So, I mean, this is a good thing. We're starting to get more info out of it.
Andy, where do people who go to employment agencies where they are they stay employed as the employment agency, but then they get farmed out. We use those people from time to time in my companies. In fact, one of my audiology, my wife's audiology practices, it's only opened 1.5 days a week. It's in a small town. And so we can't keep a person on the books for, 40 hours a week. So we went to an employment agency and they lend that person to my wife. We pay, a fee plus, we pay a hefty fee to do this. And they're really employees of the employment agency. Now, is that person considered employed?
Absolutely. They're considered, they're called temps. And they're actually, they have their own category in BLS's breakdown. They have several major categories. It's goods producing, service producing, and under service producing, they have temporary employees. And that's all the people you just talked about. Now, here's the thing. You rent this individual, and that's basically what you're doing. You're leasing
that
them or renting them for a day, a week.
That's right.
Now, let's say the employment agency can only find work for that individual 2 or 3 days a week. They're still counted as an employee.
Right.
They're not. There's no factoring involved there for that person, the level of that person's effort that they're putting in. Now, again, in the aggregate, this is difficult to really quantitate
right.
if you wanted to. They could do it, by a city. If they wanted to just look at a city like Tulsa, they could do that. But you start really running into problems when you try and put this into the aggregate for the whole country. But it's just things like that that people really need to consider. So, when I look at those numbers, I look at that, all right, the temps going up, the temps going up, the temps are going up. I count them kind of, but not really. There's a factoring that I use when I look at that kind of growth and say, is that real growth or is that just, hey, the temps, they've got people that don't want to work on Mondays, so they bring 500 more people in that are willing to work Mondays, but they're only working Mondays.
That's correct.
That kind of
right. But that person that works on Monday or Monday and Thursday part-time, they're counted the same as the person who has a full-time job making $75,000 a year. Am I correct?
Right. Here's the kicker. When BLS does their survey, and they call households, they do two surveys. There's an establishment survey, and then there's a household survey. So they poll employers like yourself, and you've probably never gotten a poll from them, have you?
No, never have.
Okay, all right. Point made. but they poll households, too. You've probably never gotten a call to your house from BLS either, have you?
No, never have.
Okay. All right. I don't know a single person who's ever been called.
Yeah, I've been in business for decades,
and
we've never had. We have two businesses.
There's somebody listening to this that's gotten a call. Please call in and let us know, because I've never heard of anybody getting called.
Right. Okay. That's interesting.
But anyway, when they do their survey, this temp that works only Mondays or Mondays and Thursdays, they call that person's house, and the person says, yeah, I'm working Mondays and Thursdays. Well, would you like to work full-time? Well, no. All right. Well, guess what? They count as fully employed. If the person says yes, then they fall into that U6 measurement.
Oh, okay. All righty. Now I
so
see
if they're
that.
Saying,
okay.
Hey, I work Monday and Thursday, but I want 5 days from these guys, they just don't have it right now, then they get counted in U6.
Okay.
So as far as what the government puts out, U6 is probably the most accurate number you're going to get from them.
Right. But U6 is down, isn't it? Was it like 23 or 24%? Now it's down to around 20%?
No, it wasn't that high. If you're talking about the 20 percentile numbers, you're talking about the old methodology
okay.
that was used back in the 80s and early 90s. John Williams over at ShadowStats, he keeps track of that, and his number is around 22% right now for unemployment,
okay.
if they measured it the same way they used to before the methodology got changed in 1992 or 3, somewhere in there it got changed.
Okay. And the government said the Bureau of Labor Statistics has U6 as about 20%?
The last reading was somewhere in the 15, high 15s, low 16s.
Oh, six, okay. Oh, okay. So there really is a divergence between what shadow statistics show and what the government is showing at this point.
Yeah, and like I said, all Williams does is tabulates the number using the old methodologies.
Right. Okay. Now companies actually production is up. Nationwide, exports are up this year over last year. We seem to be producing more. However, according to the American Institute of Economic Research, overtime is being used as well as temporary employees are being used because employers do not want to get straddled with a permanent employee, especially with all of the legislation coming on with what the employer is obligated to provide for that employee. They would rather just have a temporary employee and bypass all this legislation, apparently, from this one article. Can you say something about that?
Well, I'll tell you, the exports, and I'm not sure if you saw this, but coal exports are at a record high. So we're pulling coal out of the ground and sending it to China and different places like that. And that's a good thing. I mean, we should be right. We should be doing that kind of stuff. We have these assets. We should be using them.
Right.
Now, you know, obviously Boeing, when they make airplanes, and you know, their numbers really actually have the ability to skew the export numbers, because the bill for these planes is huge.
Right.
They sell 20 planes to, you know, some airline over in Europe, and all of a sudden exports jump significantly for that particular month that the right. that it's booked. So, you know, that you got to watch that too, because you have these outliers, and you know, hey, that's great. Boeing makes the planes here. They employ people. They export the planes. That's fantastic. We should be doing more of that kind of stuff.
Right.
You know, so I mean, there's been some good news on the export side. The thing that I'm watching more actually is the import side, and you know, we see that obviously in the case of oil. Most of your consumer goods come from somewhere else. I mean, we've talked about this. If you go into Walmart or Kmart or you know any of these places, pick up 10 items at random in that store, you're lucky if you find one that wasn't made in China or Hong Kong or Singapore.
Well, you know what's surprising? I did just that in a clothing store a few months ago, and I was surprised. They were made in countries that I never heard of before. Well, Pakistan I had, and Pakistan was one of them. And I don't remember the other two, but there was some Sri Lanka was in there, and I mean just countries that you never, never, ever hear of. All you hear is, you know, China and maybe Vietnam and stuff like that. But there were countries in there that you very, very rarely hear of. I don't remember what they were, Bolivia or something like that. So we're getting stuff from all over the world, and I think all these countries are starting to compete against one another for the export.
Oh, absolutely. And this is kind of the broken model of globalization, really, that you're getting into now, is this whole idea that the American consumer could provide enough demand to employ people in all these third world countries. And we've been doing it, but we've been doing it on debt all these years, consumer debt, corporate debt, you know, whatever, however you want to look at it. Every debt metric has been going up exponentially over the past 20 years or so. National debt, that's the biggie right now, and that's going to get bigger in the next couple of months. There's going to be another war over that in Washington. You know, but it's really at all levels. So we've been the engine, but the problem is it hasn't come honestly, and there's a price to be paid for that. And you know, people in Greece know all about it. They don't want the austerity. People in Italy, they don't want the austerity. I don't think we do either.
I don't see this huge demand of
people that are willing to march on Washington and say, "Hey, cut my Social Security, cut my Medicare, cut Medicaid, do all this stuff. We need to get off the entitlement mentality." I don't see anybody doing that.
I guess because, you know, it's transparent to them. It's either they get the money and they live pretty well. You know, the debt goes up, which is a fuzzy number somewhere thousands of miles away. It doesn't affect them. You know, or they cut back and live really on the edge, and this number that doesn't mean anything to them goes down. I mean, it's not reality to them. And the only time I suspect it's going to be reality is that when we have a real serious economic crisis, and it affects everybody.
You know what? You've just done a really good job of painting that picture, because I think that's exactly what's going on. People are so disconnected from the national debt. They have no idea where it comes from, how the money that comes into their coffers every month, whether it's Social Security or you know, health care benefits from Medicare or Medicaid or whatever the situation is, they don't have any connection to it. The only way they're going to ever know it is if it stops.
Right. That's it.
Or, I shouldn't even say if it stops. I should say when it stops. It's not going to be an if.
Andy, let's take a second just for a break, okay?
Sure.
You're listening to Liberty Talk Radio. Political talk derived from a historical perspective. Not always palatable, but good food for thought. Pure Libertarian Talk with host Joe Cristiano. LibertyTalkRadio.com.
Good evening, folks. This is Joe Cristiano. You're listening to Liberty Talk Radio. With us tonight, we have Andy Sutton, economist and chief investment strategist with Sutton & Associates, Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. We are discussing growth, inflation, unemployment, and anything else that you want to talk about when it comes to finances and economics. I do want to mention also, just take a second, that this program is now being broadcasted on 1170 KFAQ AM. I'm very, very proud that they picked up the station. Live 6 o'clock to 7 a.m. on Sunday, and a rebroadcast on 7 to 8 p.m. On Saturday. We do hope you do listen in. This evening, if you want to call in with a question, and we do urge you to do so, the number is toll-free, 888-773-4496. That's 888-773-4496. Of course, your comments are always welcome to comments at libertytalkradio.com. We really would love to hear from you. Andy, we talk constantly, what we hear from the news sources, the minutia of every day of all these numbers. To me, and I'm not an expert, but to me that's all noise. If our debt continues to rise, we're not making any headway at all, regardless of what production numbers are, how we increase exports. If the debt and the deficit and all this continues to go up, eventually there has to be an accounting for all of this, and all the little numbers, the minutia in between, is meaningless. Am I oversimplifying it?
No, not at all. And this actually plays into the inflation buzzword that gets thrown around, because this is something people don't readily understand either, because they're not directly connected to it. If you look at the broadest measure of the money supply, it was called M3. They don't release it anymore because they were saving the taxpayers all this money. It's a pet peeve of mine. I'm sorry to beat that horse. It's been dead for a long time. But if you take a look at that, you'll see that there is there's about $14.5-15 trillion that's in the broad money supply, and that includes your cash, you know, you have in your wallet. It includes your checking accounts, your savings accounts, your CDs, all of that sort of thing. There's some longer time deposits and some more technical kind of stuff, but basically it's the money that flows through the economy, and that's about $14.5-15 trillion. It does vary. It was going up, then it was going down for a while when credit contracted for a while a few years back, and now it's going up again. That is pales in comparison if you take a look at what our obligations are. We owe basically the entire money supply on the national debt that we've already racked up. So put it this way, take all the bills out of your wallet, you know, take them out from under your sofa, your mattress, wherever you hide them, take all the money out of your bank account, cash in all your CDs, all of that kind of thing. Every penny, nickel, dime, quarter, dollar, whatever, and send it to Washington. And if everybody in this country did that, I'm talking everybody, they would have about enough to pay off the national debt. And then we'd have absolutely no money in the system.
Right.
We'd have lots of credit. I mean, people would have credit cards, but there'd be no fungible money
right
in the system. That should give people an idea of where this problem is at right now. Now, let's get into the next thing. Last August, we had this huge debt ceiling debate. It was all over the news. This side postured, that side postured. In the end, they all agreed that we're just going to continue to rack up debt, but we're going to try and put off the next debate over this until after the scoundrels get reelected. And I do mean scoundrels. When we were having this debate, the national debt was a tad over $14 trillion. When we have the next debate over this, which is going to happen at some point in the next 6 months, that national debt's going to be almost $16 trillion. So that gives you an idea of how fast it's growing. It is becoming exponential. The curve, if you look at the value or the you know the the hole, the size of the hole we've dug for ourselves, it's becoming a parabola shape. So it was increasing gradually, greater and greater, and now it's just taken off. And that's how this is going to go. It's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. There's no political will, either amongst the people or amongst the politicians, to affect any meaningful reform to stop this.
Yeah.
So this is going to happen. It's going to run up, and you know, you take a look at the net present value of all these claims that we have in the future that we have no revenues for. It's over $200 trillion. Our national debt will get there at some point, unless the whole thing just goes kaboom, or somebody actually, or many somebodies, stand up and say enough is enough. Now, concomitant with this is the fact that they're going to have to print a lot more money to meet all these obligations.
Right.
That's inflation. It's not gas went from 355 to 356. That is not inflation.
Right.
That's how the government reports inflation. They say, well, the consumer price index went up 0.2% this month. That's the effect of inflation.
Right. Right.
If you have $14 trillion, say we'll round it down, $14 trillion floating around the United States of America as a money supply, there's going to be a certain general price level that accommodates the purchase of all the goods that are available here in this country, right?
Right. Exactly.
Can't pay more than the money exists.
Right.
I think everybody understands that. Now, let's double that. Let's make it $28 trillion. Do you think the price level is going to stay the same? You've got $28 trillion now instead of $14 trillion chasing the same quantity of goods.
Bingo. Loaf of bread is $5.
There you go.
Right.
That's inflation. The printing, the issuance of credit, the issuance of money above and beyond the level of goods available in the economy, or the growth of the level of goods available, that's the inflation. It's a monetary event. The government sits there and says, well, inflation was down. No, inflation was not down. The effects of inflation might have been down on a particular month,
right.
And we could spend an hour
right.
talking about how they fudge those numbers.
Right.
You know, and I've done it in many articles, and there's plenty of other people that have. It's an absolute joke. So now they want to have this chain-weighted CPI now, so they're going to do more hedonics. And basically, I'll give you one example. If they used to use, I don't know, filet mignon, what does a pound of filet mignon cost? Well, if that went in the basket of goods that they used to measure the consumer price index, well, now the price of filet mignon is going up too fast. All right, well, that doesn't look good, because that makes the Fed look bad. It makes the government look incompetent. So, all right, we're going to take that filet mignon out. We're going to use hamburger instead.
Right.
So you go from, what, a $7, $8, $10 a pound down to $2 a pound.
Right.
Oh, inflation went down last month.
Right.
That's
right.
How they do it, literally. You know, pretty soon they're going to have us all eating Purina kitten chow. This keeps up. Well, the price inflation went down. The price of dog food just went down by 0.2%. You know, this is the kind of nonsense.
Yeah.
And I'm exaggerating here a little bit, but that's
about
what they do.
Yeah. Andy, I'm going to pronounce his name incorrectly, and I shouldn't, because he's been on my program a long time ago. Dr. Kutlikoff, am I pronouncing that mm-hmm. correctly? Did I pronounce that correctly?
That's exactly right.
Oh, thank goodness. Of course, if he's ever listening in, he'd just never speak to me again. Well, I read an article by him very recently that he indicated that our national debt is actually $211 trillion, which includes the unfunded liabilities. And the way he calculated the unfunded liabilities is what the government is committed to less what the government is anticipating collecting. So it is, in fact, a net figure. And that net figure is $211 trillion. You know, the planet Earth is not worth $211 trillion.
Not yet.
No, really. When you think about it, it's just such a phenomenal
figure. To give you a comparison,
yeah.
If you take the total number, the assets, you know, if you looked at the United States of America, you, myself, everybody who's listening, all of our assets is one company. It's about $50 trillion. That's
yeah.
about the asset side
yeah.
of the U.S. of A.
Yeah.
So you're looking at assets that are about 25% of the net present value of all these unfunded liabilities. That's what we call fiscal gap.
Yeah.
That's the difference. And basically what he does is he takes it out over two generations and brings it all back into the present. And that's how that number's arrived at.
Well, what's interesting there, Andy, is that if you take those figures that Dr. Kutlikoff is presenting in his article, and we continue to go on the path we're going as he has projected it, that means that I don't recall the number of years, 10, 20 years, whatever, out. We will be in debt by $211 trillion and not 15 or 16 trillion.
Now, yeah, the 15 or 16 is what we've actually accrued to date.
To date, right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you can imagine.
This is what we're going to accrue, what he's talking about.
All right. Now, here's my problem. You have the Saudis taking petrodollars for oil. There's got to be a time where the Saudis say, well, I don't want it. Or if they do that, there'll be a collapse in worldwide panic. But they're going to ask for more. Now, I spoke with an oil producer today, a guy who actually owns wells and sucks the stuff out of the grounds. He indicated that he doesn't anticipate the price of oil getting all that much higher, only because if prices get too high, people will stop driving, drive less, or drive smaller cars. It will, a carpool and whatever. And so that will put a damper on the demand. He said, so that basically he feels that and there's plenty of oil out there still. So he says, we will continue on this trajectory that we are now and not be too much higher, short of a war in the Middle East, et cetera, et cetera. I forgot where I was going with this.
I know exactly where you're going.
But however, I said, well, I'm a big investor in oil. That's my second biggest investment is oil. I have gas and stuff like that. And I said, one of the reasons why I have it is not only do I believe that the prices will be going up, I mean, the prices of the stock will be going up that I have, however, but it's a hedge against inflation. I said, is that a correct assumption? Is that the right thing to do? He said, absolutely. So he's saying oil is really money, but it will be adjusted for inflation. And I thought that was interesting, and it's a good way of looking at it from a guy who produces the stuff.
Yeah, I mean he makes a very good point, and that's a philosophy that that I use here in house. Anything that's tangible and has a fixed supply, there's this argument or this position that the Saudis can pump infinite amounts of oil, and that's just hogwash. But basically, what you have here, I mean, if you take a look, and I wrote about this several weeks ago, if you take a look at petrol demand, is motor gasoline. It's not going up. They talk about this recovery that's going on.
Right.
And generally, when you see an economic recovery, you see an increase in the demand of oil and byproducts because people are, more people driving to work. You've got more activity, more power is being used, and just it goes right down the line. And we're not seeing that. And so basically what you have here is a rate-limiting cycle. If the economy, say they pump enough money, enough funny money into this whole mess, to really stimulate fake growth, you're going to have demand go up, prices are going to take off, and it's going to be like a governor, if you will, like you have in a car.
That's right, yeah,
where
exactly.
You hit 65 miles an hour, and all of a sudden you can't push the gas pedal down anymore.
Yeah.
That's basically what we have with regards to petroleum. So, the guy is right. There's going to be a situation there where it's going to be a rate-limiting cycle. But the kicker is, the more dollars that you have in the system that are chasing those barrels of oil, those barrels of gasoline, whatever the case may be, the price is going to go up. Now, there's all kinds of stunts that are being used, and they do this in the gold and silver markets on a regular basis. They try to keep these prices in check by, going short on futures contracts and doing that type of stuff. So on the paper side, that's what they use to try to control prices. So we don't really have a very good idea of what a baseline price ought to be, but based on last year in 2008 and some of the anecdotal information, we see a serious decline in demand at around $4 a gallon. The economy just, it can't do it, even with all the credit that's available.
Right.
We can't support more than $4. You really
right.
see demand start to get throttled.
Right.
So that's, for now, is kind of like the ceiling, if
right.
you will.
Exactly.
But
that's what he's
moving forward, you know, you got the rest of the world that's still burning oil like crazy. China's still growing. You know, some of these other countries, you know, there's all this talk of a European recession. You know, any of these recessions is gonna actually help this situation, because you're not gonna have as much of a demand. You know, we're losing 10 refineries this year. And in Washington State right now, in Oregon, they're paying over $5 a gallon because there's a refinery that had a fire back in February, and there's a couple others that are down for routine maintenance. So we're losing all this refining capacity. We're going to be importing finished gas before too long.
Yeah.
So, you know, you just kind of throw that in there. And I know we got off the beaten path a little bit here, but, you know, this is an important component when you start talking about inflation and prices and all of this kind of thing. You start adding all this money to the system because we have to create all these dollars to pay for these, you know, out of control obligations. It's going to hit the floor at some point.
Yeah.
And
well,
that's the way it is.
And not everyone in the United States pays the same amount for crude oil. For example, in Mid-America, our crude oil price is based on West Texas Intermediate. But on the East Coast, they have to get theirs from overseas, and they're paying Brent crude prices. So there are differences in prices of what we pay for crude. And then in the West Coast, they have to rely primarily on California, Colorado, and places like that for their crude oil. And that's closer akin, apparently, to the West Texas Intermediate, although they have supply and demand situations. But, you know, this brings up another. We talk about the economy. And yet, people are looking for this economy to rebound and get back to, you know, a growth rate of 5% and 7%. Even if everything is going beautifully, smoothly, we recover. The fact is, we are a mature economy. We are no longer a growing economy as we were back in the 1940s and 1950s and the early part of 1960s. Now that we're mature, and mature economies don't grow at 5 to 7%. They grow at the rate of around 2 or 3% at best. And that's about where we are. So that's about the best that we can hope for. Is that true?
Yes, here's the kicker on that, though, and this is going to tell you exactly how bad things are. And Krugman had an article that kind of danced around this point. We're getting 1 1/8 to 2 1/8, call it, annualized growth per quarter at this point in the ballgame. To do that, we're borrowing over $1 trillion a year.
Right.
To get that, and that's anemic. That's very anemic growth. And all that borrowed money that the government takes and spends into the economy counts in that GDP number. So what you're looking at there is a total, that gets into the third point, the third area, which is growth. That's a totally bogus measurement because it's based on money that's borrowed. It's based on a transaction that has no termination. It's reversible. At some point, this money has to be paid back. But the problem is we have a sickness in our country, and it pervades academia, it pervades government, and it's called Keynesianism.
Right.
And if you're a Keynesian, you don't care about debt because in your sick little mind, it never needs to be repaid.
Right.
We borrow the money, and we never pay it back. That's the mentality.
Well, the Keynesians believe, well, since we owe it to ourselves, it's really not a debt, so we can do this forever. But when you extend that out, you say, well, in that case, why don't we just print a few $1 trillion, give it to everyone, make everyone millionaires, and this will be a rich country.
Yeah, and then we'll be paying $10 a loaf for bread. Yeah, you're exactly right.
Right, and it doesn't make any sense.
The big lie about the national debt is we don't owe it to ourselves.
That's right.
You know, they look at that portion of it that's called intergovernmental borrowings, and they say, well, you know, that's money that we borrowed from Social Security to pay off, you know, this pension program or, you know, this pork barrel program or whatever the situation may be. Well, that's money that we took out of this piggy bank here and we put into a, you know, we put the IOU back in. So it's really money that we owe to ourselves. The problem is, A, the United States government doesn't issue money to itself. The Federal Reserve issues money. The Federal Reserve is not part of the government. Now, you get this foolish school of thought that says, well, you know, the Fed takes their earnings at the end of the year and they give it back to the Treasury. Big whoop.
Right.
So we pay them interest to borrow the money from them so we can use it in our economy. So we pay them for the privilege of using their debt to run our economy. That's how it works.
Yeah.
So we don't owe this money to ourselves, ultimately. It's owed to the Federal Reserve. and that includes the debt that's owed to the Chinese. Ultimately, it all belongs to the Fed.
Right. But, you know,
they're the ones that issue the dollars. That started in 1913. That scam has been going for almost 100 years now. That's the big elephant that nobody wants to talk about.
How much money
is ultimately owed to an international bank.
How much longer can we go at zero interest rates?
Well, they're going to try and keep this going for a while. And basically what you've got here, we're working on the same framework that Europe is right now. You know, you talk about Greece and Italy and all these other countries, Spain now, you know, they're all in trouble. They've all ceded their sovereignty. They've given up their economic freedom to this idea of this union, this currency union, this
right.
economic cooperative union that they have going on over there. And now they're handcuffed. You know, the Greeks, they don't issue drachmas anymore. They have to run hat in hand to the IMF and the European Central Bank to get money to pay off their debts.
Right.
And if they don't take on the debt slavery that that's called austerity, by the way, that the ECB and the IMF want to impose upon them, well, then they say, well, you're not getting the money. So you're going to, and granted, you know what, they've been on a free ride for a while, a lot of those people over there, and they need to work for their bread. I mean, I'm sorry. They're going to hate me for this, and they can email me and whatever, but they have to work for their money.
Right.
You don't just get to sit on your fanny and do nothing and collect checks. And we're learning this lesson right now, and we're going to learn it the hard way, because we're doing the exact same thing. We ceded our sovereignty 199 years ago to the Federal Reserve.
Right.
And
exactly.
when the U.S.
Exactly
government
the
wants
point.
To borrow, guess what? It runs hat in hand to who? The
right.
Fed.
Right.
The Fed prints the money. The Fed's buying like 70% of the Treasury bonds now. So who's buying all this debt? The Federal Reserve.
Right. All right, Andy, let's just stop right there, and we are past due for station identification. Hold on, please. Don't go away.
You're listening to Liberty Talk Radio. Political talk derived from a historical perspective. Not always palatable, but good food for thought. Pure libertarian talk with host Joe Cristiano. LibertyTalkRadio.com.
Good evening, folks. This is Joe Cristiano. You're listening to Liberty Talk Radio. Our toll-free number is 888-773-4496. That's 888-773-4496. Do not be bashful. I get emails saying, oh, wonderful program. Andy is wonderful. We know he's wonderful. I would have called, but I didn't want to interrupt. Please interrupt. Right, Andy? You're okay with that, aren't you?
Interrupt. Let's correct. Andy's not wonderful. I'm just a god. Now, here's the thing, and this is something else that really frosts me. They have this media, the government, the academia, they have the average person convinced that economics requires graduate study and all this other hogwash to understand it. Now, you know what? If you want to get into the stats and the math and modeling and all that kind of stuff, sure. You know, the coursework obviously helps.
Right.
But if you just want to look at macro stuff, it's common sense.
Right.
And that's the big secret. The average person out there that's listening to this show can grasp every single thing that we've talked about here. It doesn't require any special training, any classes. You know, you don't have to buy the book and CD and do it at home and mail it back. You know, you can just look at it, and does it make sense?
No.
Are the things we're doing sustainable
yeah.
in the long run?
Yeah.
And does it make sense? If it doesn't make sense, guess what? We probably shouldn't be doing it.
Right. You know,
and really, when you think about it, economics is that simple.
Yeah,
hard to understand.
Yeah. My mom was a I'm not sure what she graduated. I'm not sure if she graduated high school or not. But you know, she's of the old school, and I'm 69, so you can imagine when she graduated if she graduated high school. I don't recall. She did not drive. She stayed home. But yet she exercised what we used to call home economics, and she did a great job. She wasn't, in fact, an economist for our home. I mean, she kept inventory of what we needed to eat, and she balanced the checkbooks and made sure that, you know, if we had no money, we didn't go anywhere, we didn't buy anything. And if we had a little bit of money, then she, put it in the bank and saved it. She understood economics. As I mean, as a simple woman as she was, and she was a wonderful, wonderful wife. She was an angel on earth, this woman, you know. But she was, in fact, involved in economics. So you're right. You don't have to, you know, take a class at night to find out what to do. Look at your checkbook. Look at how much you owe. Look at where you're going. Look at what you're getting involved in. And you're an economist. Every one of us are economists.
Exactly. All it is the process of human decision-making in terms of allocation of scarce resources. And
right.
That sounds like a mouthful, but think about it.
Yep.
You have a limited amount of money to use. You have needs that need to be met. Why is a city or a township or a county or a state or a national government any different than what your mom did or what the millions of moms in this country do or what people around the world do? Why does it have to be different? Why is a country allowed to carry 15 and change trillion dollars in debt when it's only able to tax about 1/7 of that on an annual basis? So that's like you going home and saying, all right, I made a dollar this year, but I have 7 in debt.
Right.
That's ridiculous. You know, that does not work for the average household. It doesn't work for any household, at least not very long. Maybe for a little while it will, and that's kind of where we're at. We think because this is the U.S. government, we're America, that this cloaks us in immunity from the laws of economics, and it doesn't.
Yeah. Well,
and people will say, well, Andy, this hasn't, you know, you guys are always talking and all this stuff, and nothing bad has happened yet. I can still do whatever I want. Yeah. Well, you know what? The people in Europe were saying that, too, up until about a year or two ago.
Right. Well,
and Europe's first world, guys. You know, the Euro, big time, Germany, industrial nation, first world economy, you know, the whole nine yards. Hey, nobody's immune. And
right.
We need to get that through our heads.
Right.
And you know what? We're not going to fix this federal government. There's no way. It's too corrupt. It's a cesspool. But you can fix your own backyard. And if your backyard's clean, guess what? You probably know somebody who isn't.
Yeah.
So you can urge your neighbors to do the same thing. And we can take care of ourselves. And that's about all we're going to do. We're not going to change Washington. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, you can run for school boards and try and fix things on that level and try and work on a micro scale. And, you know, if you get a huge groundswell of support for, you know, self-embraced austerity, we'll call it, you might get something to, you know, trickle up through the ranks. But, you know, starting and saying, you know what, we're going to write letters to Congress. You know what, they're not listening. They don't care.
Oh, yeah, writing letters, I mean,
They talked about letters all day long, right? And then in the end, they all agreed to stick it to us for another year and a half while they ran their re-election campaign. So you see where the priorities are.
Yeah, well, they couldn't read
the
letters anyway. They can't read the letters. They can't answer the letters. You get a form letter back. It has nothing to do with what you
said.
Exactly.
It's a waste of time.
Yeah, an absolute waste of time. And, you know, we shouldn't be wasting our valuable, finite resource being time sending letters to those clowns that should know what the heck to do. And we're not going to change. We should never have to write a letter, and I refuse to do that. Let me ask you a question. We are our credit rating now, according to S&P, is AA+ rather than AAA. We are going to we're bumping against the upper limit. Are we not of the national debt again? Is this what's happening?
Yeah, we're getting there. I mean, that last increase was supposed to get them through the next election. Projections are varied, but it looks like there's a reasonable possibility that there might be another big debate on this before the next election. So they're actually, you know, there was a big hullabaloo about the very minuscule surplus that they ran during the tax month of April.
Right.
But the projections are that they're probably going to hit this limit again before Election Day. Well, and S&P, AA+, give me a break.
It should be FFF-, $211 trillion in unfunded liabilities. Give me a break.
Andy, excuse me, Andy. I can hear your voice, but you sound like a monster. Is it something wrong with your phone, or is it on my end?
I think it's on your end.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Andy, we may have to cut this interview short. Boy, you sound scary. Can you hear me on a can you hear me clearly?
You sound fine.
Oh my God! If you can listen to the end of the broadcast when we put it online, and don't speak anymore. By the way, and it's absolutely scary the way you sound. You sound like one of those monster guys. Anyway, but we're going to have to terminate this program 10 minutes early, only because Andy's coming in like a monster man, and he's not a monster man. He's a heck of a nice guy, and no use, you know, extending this for 10 minutes. We won't be able to understand you, and I have no idea what the what our listeners are hearing. So,
do you want me to call back?
Why don't you do that? Yeah, I'll, why don't you do that? Yeah, just call back and let's see what happens. Right, and we'll hold. Okay, bye bye. Oh boy, folks, just hold on there 1 second, please. And we do have someone on the line that wants to ask a question. That's area code 765. Just hold for a second. I want to get Andy back on the line before I answer. I put you on the line. Uh-oh, someone just left also. I'm sorry to hear that. People, please do not leave. Let's see if Andy calls back. Andy, you're not coming through yet. Oh, boy. We must have had a real problem on the line. He does not seem to be coming back. But I'm going to take this call. Here he comes. Let's see what happens now. Andy, is that you? Andy, is that you? Andy? Andy, is that you? Andy, is that you? Andy? Well, folks, it looks like we have a telephone situation which will not go away. We also lost our other callers. There's something, it must be on our end because our other callers also dropped off, and we apologize for that. Andy, is that you? Now everyone has dropped off. Okay. We're going to end this, and we apologize. We're going to end it about 10 minutes early. But this has been a terrific program. Andy always does a terrific job of explaining what's going on. Let's see if we can get this person back on the line. Caller, you're on the air. It's area code 765. Did you have a question or a comment? Nope, no one's coming through. I'm awfully sorry. No one's coming through at all. It must be in our in some of our telephone platform. Something just went totally screwy, and we apologize for that. So we're going to end the program. I'm just going to put our bumper song on and end the program. I sincerely apologize for all the. Let me try one more time. Nope, I just can't seem to get anyone going at all. So let's see if we can get this going here. We'll end the program tonight. Boy.
Political talk derived from a historical perspective.
Okay. Well, apparently I'm coming across real raspy also. So we will discontinue this program. Thank you very much for listening to Liberty Talk Radio. If you can understand me at all, please go to our website, and it'll tell you all about our program on 1170 KFAQ, as well as our online program weekly. All right, thank you very much for listening in.